The Politics Show on Radio Reverb 97.2 FM.
Welcome to this month's edition of the Radio Reverb Politics Show. I'm Geoffrey Bowden. The principal focus for this month's show is on the often low rates of pay in the third sector. That's mostly charities and community interest companies, and the knock-on impact this has. They deliver vital services to some of the city's most vulnerable citizens, but often rely on workers who are expected to survive on rates of pay that can well be well below the living wage, currently set at £8.45 per hour in Brighton and Hove. The local authority buys services from such organisations. As I said, that's the main focus of the programme, but first joining me in the studio is Beth Munro, who is out to get your vote to win a grant from Aviva's Good Thinking Community Fund to ensure that more schools get to learn about the importance of politics. Welcome, Beth.
Thank you.
Tell listeners what this is all about.
So when I was in my final year of university, which was last year, I set up a group called Politics in Education, otherwise known as PIE. And we go into local schools and youth centres in Brighton and Hove, and we run workshops on basic politics. And the whole idea of it is to get young people not only more educated on politics, but also just more engaged, finding it relatable to them, finding it more interesting, and hopefully planting a seed that will then develop into a more political interest later on in their lives.
And what has the reaction been from the students?
It's been incredibly positive. Most of the students we've worked with have a lot to say. They all have opinions on things and really want their voice to be heard. They're just not often given the space for it to be heard. And a lot of the... So we first go to the Brighton Youth Centre and we discuss with them our ideas and whether they think that politics is something they would be interested in having in their schools. And the response from them has been really positive. And
is there some nervousness on part of the teachers who think you might be peddling some party political message?
All of the teachers we've been in contact with have been really behind the idea and saying, you know, we wish that we could teach politics in schools, but it's not on the curriculum.
There's a prohibition, is there?
Well, in the curriculum, there's citizenship, where there's supposedly, you know, some free rein for teachers to put politics in there, but it's not compulsory at all. And I think that because of the sort of contentious nature of politics and teachers not wanting to think they're coming across as bias or swaying students one way or the other, they tend to avoid it.
Yes, I mean, I come from an era back in, you know, the way gone, where current affairs was a set subject.
Oh,
so
wow.
We did get to discuss what was going on in the world, so we weren't quite so insular. What's your take on votes at 16?
That's an interesting one. We often get the young people to have a debate on this. And it's interesting because a lot of them are actually against votes at 16. What most of them say is that people at 16 don't know enough to be able to vote. But then
maybe that's because they're not being taught about
exactly.
current affairs in schools.
And I think that it's silly to think that as soon as you get to 18, you're suddenly hit by some epiphany and you know everything there is to know about politics. That just doesn't happen. And a lot of grown-ups, people older than 18, you know, people up to 100 are voting and they don't necessarily know any more than a 16-year-old. So I think once there's education on politics, then it can be open up to anyone who's wanting to vote.
Now, it is said that the last snap general election, Labour Party gained so many votes,
yes.
And the profile of the new voters was predominantly young people.
Yeah.
So it does look as if young people are interested.
Yeah, absolutely.
And can be inspired by the right kind of political leader, whether it's someone from the Labour Party or the Conservatives or even the Lib Dems.
Yeah.
Or even the Green Party.
Yes.
So there is interest. I mean, the other thing also I just came across, the very first programme in this series on Radio Reverb was about potential cuts to youth clubs and youth centres. And this potential downsizing of the money mobilised young people. And
yeah.
We definitely saw young people engaged because the subject really touched their hearts
Absolutely.
And their lives.
Brighton Youth Centre, the young people there got very mobilised and actually managed to stop the cuts from being so big to their services. So that was really impressive.
OK, well, Beth, thank you so much for coming
thank
in.
Thank you.
Best of luck in the vote.
Thank we you
will,
very much.
Put a link on the programme page, and we'll probably do a little bit of social media as well.
Great.
To help you over that 1,000 vote mark. So thank you for coming in.
Thank you very much for having me.
The Politics Show on Radio Reverb 97.2 FM.
OK, I think probably it's best to go round the table. And so if you'd like to introduce yourselves, say who you are, and then the listeners can get used to your voices. So starting on my right or left.
Thank you, Geoffrey. I'm Maria Antoniou. I'm currently a charity consultant. I've worked in the community sector in Brighton and Hove for the last 9 years.
Well, I've said nearly 10 years in the...
Nearly 10 years.
I'm in PR, yeah. Of course. And introduce yourself.
I'm Frances Duncan, and I'm the Chief Exec of the Clock Tower Sanctuary. And I, too, have worked in the sector for a very long time.
And finally...
I'm Andy Winter. I'm from Brighton Housing Trust, and I've been there for 32 years.
Right. OK, well, that sets the tone. So, now, you kicked this whole subject off, Maria, by going online, because you were in the middle of jobs. I think you're working for a local charity on a pro-tem basis at the moment, Rise. We might as well give them a plug. And you spotted that some charities were advertising jobs at well below the living wage rate in Brighton and Hove. So this presumably got your dander up a bit.
Yes. Well, being a charity sector worker, I'm used to looking at jobs quite regularly because the nature of the sector is short-term contracts. People move around a lot, so I'm always keeping an eye on community-based jobs and other local job sites. And I quite regularly see jobs advertised at very low rates. And on this particular day, I'd seen one, I think it was for £7.90 an hour, and it was a full-time job. It was in supported housing locally, and I just thought it was outrageous that somebody was being expected to do a very demanding job caring for vulnerable people or supporting vulnerable people, but was potentially being made vulnerable themselves by having such a low income. And we all know what the cost of living is here and the cost of rents and mortgages. And I've had some horror stories that I've heard over the years of people in the community
sector. But in fairness, this turned out to be a human error because an old living wage rate was being changed.
No.
What was being used...
That was actually a different organisation, yes.
Right, so
but I did also give the example of Brighton Housing Trust and another job that was advertised at the same time for I think £7.90 an hour. Andy, yes, has later corrected that and said that that was an error. But the original job was actually for a different organisation, okay. Which I'm not going to name, it's not fair.
No.
But they're an organisation that's based outside of... a charity that's based outside of Brighton, but they do work
deliver,
here.
They deliver services here,
yeah.
OK, I mean, you're newly in post in the
Clock Tower Sanctuary.
And you're a board member of the...
Chamber of Commerce.
Andy, you are too?
I am, yeah.
And the Chamber of Commerce is leading on the living wage campaign locally. Just give me an insight into how many companies have taken up the challenge in Brighton and Hove.
When I looked yesterday, there were 347 organisations in Brighton and Hove that were living wage employers.
Right. OK, so, and of those, I believe there's quite a high proportion that are third sector.
Yes, a significant proportion are from the third sector.
And how many of that? Can we put a number on it?
Hang on, let me look at my piece of paper.
I saw a survey that the Living Wage campaign did.
18 of the 347.
OK, but there are many more charities around.
Oh, no, sorry, it's more than 18. That's the number that filled in a survey. Do you know how many?
I don't off the top of my head, no, sorry.
Sorry.
OK, but we are doing reasonably well. But the impact of being a living wage employer, Andy, you've said in that little pre-chat we've had, is that if you apply the living wage to your costings when you're going for a parcel of work from the local authority, it can severely disadvantage you, you or any other third sector organisation. What's the impact? Do you actually fail to get work because you're paying a decent wage?
Yeah. I think Brighton Housing Trust has lost contracts in the past because we don't do well on competitiveness when it comes to price, because we are a living wage employer. All our jobs, since we were one of the first adopters of the living wage in Brighton and Hove, have been at living wage rates. But when you go into a competitive tender and 40% or 60% is down to cost, and your cost base is 10, 12, 15% higher than people coming in from outside Brighton, and also some Brighton charities, then you are at an inbuilt disadvantage. It's a principle that we're prepared to stand by, even though it has cost us some contracts in the past.
Okay, I mean, isn't there a simple solution to this? I mean, maybe Francis, you'd like to comment. If we could persuade the local authority to only commission work from third sector companies, organisations that pay the living wage, that would be a step in the right direction to achieving more realistic costed services.
I think it'd be an absolutely first step towards equalising the playing field on commissioning and contracting, but also it would be putting the money where their mouth is about saying that they want an economy that's sustainable and where people are properly valued by their employers and properly able to live and work in the city.
I think actually a few months ago there was a survey of activity initiated by the council, and there was a huge amount of 0 hours contracts that they were responsible for. So there is a bit of hypocrisy. Maybe when Dan Yates, chair of the Health and Wellbeing Board, joins us later on in the show, we can put both those propositions to him, that, you know, A, get rid of 0 hours contracts, and B, only allow the commissioners to commission services from third sector organisations who are signed up to the living wage campaign.
Yes, I think that would be fantastic.
It almost feels like we've game over. We don't need to talk about it anymore.
It might not be legal to say they will only do that. I think what they could do, though, is give a premium in the scoring of, say, 20 points, pass or fail, are you a living wage employer? So you couldn't say if you're not a living wage employer. So if things are judged out of 100%, put 20% on a yes-no answer, are you a living wage employer? And if you get yes, you get a 20% advantage. That would soon get people learning better ways.
OK, let's take a break there. Maria, I come to you first. This is your Desert Island Disc moment. What have you chosen to have played on the show? And if you've got a reason for it, it can be just that you like the music, nothing more than that. But tell listeners what it is you've chosen.
OK, well, as we all were as teenagers, we all loved music. But as I've grown up, I haven't really listened to music, bought new music. But recently, this singer, Carla Bruni, caught my attention, and especially this track, Enjoy the Silence, which is a cover of a Depeche Mode track from the 80s, I think.
Now, Carla's she had a famous spouse, didn't she? Or has a famous spouse?
Yeah, she's the former First Lady of France. So was Nicolas Sarkozy's
Well,
wife.
He probably had,
she still is.
A nice little lullaby sung to him every night. let's listen to that track.
Thank you.
Welcome back, and a very nice choice that was too. So we were talking about a simple solution. How realistic is it, do you think, that we can persuade the politicians that this is the right course to take? Maria, you've raised this whole thing. You're the hornet in this little nest. Tell us what you think.
Well, it feels like I'm the activist in the room. So I think the council putting firmer boundaries in place for their funding is important. It is an important step, not just the council, any statutory sector funder, or indeed any other funder. But I think charities do have a role to play. We can't just play the blame the council game. So I think charities do have a role and a duty to look at their internal pay structures and look at the disparity between the highest paid and the lowest paid and perhaps undergo a pay review if they haven't had one for a while. And I know, Andy, that your finance director role came up recently, and it was a very highly paid role in the job advert. I think it was around 80,000.
No,
was it not? Would you like to correct me on that?
No, it was a fair bit less than that.
A fair bit less. Okay. Well, it just seemed disproportionately high. And I know you're a large organisation and you're a housing provider and not just a local charity, but it just struck me that there is a huge disparity in some organisations between the highest paid and the lowest paid, and there may have to be some work done within organisations about pay structures and not just blaming the council.
But isn't there a bit of a conundrum here? Because most charities struggle on the finances. They don't just depend on local authorities. They have to have an ongoing fundraising campaign. And there are a lot of people out there with buckets and open hands asking for money. So they can only pay what they can pay, I guess, based on their core income. Andy, you're pretty active on the fundraising mm-hmm. front. How much of your income is dependent on fundraising activities in order to deliver the services that you're seeking to provide?
Well, we have to raise 200,000 a year, but as people will have seen in the media recently, we are struggling to keep the Whitehawk Inn going. So that is it would be another 100,000 if we were to achieve that. So it is an ongoing battle. When you look at an organisation like Brighton Housing Trust, you have to realise it's really several organisations under one umbrella, and they're very, very different. So on the housing side, there's one economy. And on the charity side, so where you have our high charitable mission fit in to do with rough sleeping and immigration and asylum work, they're never going to make any money. So the housing side has to make big surpluses in order to reinvest. We have a £17 million investment programme over the next 30 years for our homes that we provide to people. Keeping First Base running, which sees the majority of rough sleepers, we have to raise £100,000 each year to keep that going. Our advice service, and particularly the immigration legal service, runs at a £250,000 deficit each year. So all things are put into a mix. I think the earlier point about differentials between pay, I know Jeremy Corbyn is calling for a pay differential of no more than 20 to 1. So we did a review, we did a gender equality review, and we did a comparison, and we are well within that 20 to 1 ratio. In fact, our biggest ratio is 5 to 1.
Right. Now, you're also, Francis, you're also working with a charity that looks after homeless people. Is this your experience? I know you've been in post for a shortish time.
Yeah.
But is this... what Andy has just said, does that echo with you in terms of the ratio of money needed to be raised to deliver the services?
Yes, so Clock Tower Sanctuary raise about 80% of their income every year from community-based fundraising. So about 20% comes from grant-making trusts and foundations, but the rest we raise through our community activity. I think Maria's point is really interesting, and I guess what organisations need to do around both being able to pay the living wage and around sustainability is to take a strategic approach to fundraising to ensure that they always look to cover their full costs. So full cost recovery 10 years ago was quite frowned upon, both by the local authority and by grant-making trusts and foundations. Charities were somehow expected to find the money for all members of staff from somewhere else, and they only wanted to pay for the frontline workers. But there's been a real sea change around that, and now it is seen as very acceptable that you incorporate all of your costs into a funding bid. So that's changed. So I think there is an opportunity to change the hearts and minds of people who do the funding to ensure that the living wage is supported.
I mean, do you think that, you guys, Andy and Francis, are both involved in the living wage through the Chamber of Commerce, but maybe Maria, because you act as a consultant as well as working frontline with some of these charities, do you think better rates of pay for frontline staff will actually motivate the intake of better quality people and actually get people to stay in post for longer?
Well, I think the frontline staff are of a high quality already, yes. And they're very motivated and they do more than they are paid for. So I don't think quality is the issue there. This city has a wealth of experience, a wealth of skills, and people who are just not being paid fairly and having to live in some pretty terrible conditions because of that. I've known people who spend all day kind of supporting others in the community sector, doing very stressful work, and then going back and sleeping in somebody else's shed in the night time. Somebody else told me that they were living in a very mouldy room in a shared house and they just couldn't afford to move out of there because of their salary in the local sector. So the quality is really not the issue. I would just like to go back to full cost recovery, if I may, because I'm from the academic sector originally. And in the mid 2000s, about around 2004, 2005, if I remember, things shifted towards a full cost recovery model. So the funders of academic work, academic research, are very used to paying full cost recovery. This actually negatively affects the community sector or the local charities when they're partnering with the university, because we have to go through all this full cost recovery checking, and it puts an extra layer of bureaucracy in. But so the government or funders who fund academic research, who are often statutory bodies, are very used to funding on a full cost recovery model, but that hasn't filtered down to the charity sector and to organisations that need it the most. So it's not just councils, it's funders across the board who need to look at the full cost recovery model.
We're getting slightly technical, and I hope we're not losing some of the listeners, but I want to just come back to the role that the local authority plays, because they are big paymasters ultimately of local charitable services, and if they continue just to go for the lowest price, regardless of what pay is on offer to the people delivering the services, we're never going to get out of this vicious cycle. So I don't know. We're going to talk to Dan Yates in a moment, and maybe what is a take-home message that we should be giving to Dan, who can influence the commissioners that are working in the same building as he.
I think the race to the bottom compromises quality and thereby compromises safety. And what we've seen, not in Brighton and Hove, but elsewhere where we've gone for contracts where we might have had them in the past and lost them, the new people coming in discover that they haven't costed their contracts properly and the contracts have failed. And so we've seen some pretty poor commissioning, and I think there's a real issue about the quality of commissioning within local authorities. Across the board.
And the NHS.
I have less experience of the NHS. But we have, on occasions, had a commissioner saying to us, why are you putting a 2% or 4% margin on this? We thought you were a not-for-profit organisation.
Yeah, but we need to pay our staff.
We have to pay our staff, and we also have to mitigate our risk. Because when you're having to pay 250 people a month, and their mortgages and their rents are dependent, you need to make sure that you're properly costed those contracts. So very often commissioners have never actually worked in a business environment where you have to look at the realities of cash flow, of balance sheets, and making sure that your responsibilities to your employees are met, not just this month, but over the next, you can see over the next 5 years.
Do you think, I've just another question really about commissioning, because I've got my own views on that, and as a presenter I shouldn't be pushing those particularly, but there have been some significant commissioning failures recently, and I'm thinking of Co-Performer in the NHS,
exactly,
which needed to transport people to and from hospital appointments, outpatients, and frankly, the failure of that service put people's lives at risk. But do you think also the commissioners are too loath to give long-term contracts to third sector organisations. I'm a director of another charity in the sector where instead of giving us a three-year contract, they gave us a two-year contract. And I've seen this replicated elsewhere, which makes forward planning very difficult. You're a consultant, Maria. What's your take on that?
I'm not really talking from my consultancy work on this one, but I have previously managed a charity and been involved in bidding to the council. And I think they're in a difficult position as well because their funding is not stable and they have uncertainty and they've had to make redundancies. So I really, there are things they can do, but I really don't want to play the blame the council game.
But Francis, it can't help if you get a two-year contract. How can you forward plan staffing levels?
I think it is really difficult because almost as soon as you've started the contract, you're thinking about applying for the next time round. Yeah. So that lack of time to forward plan, the lack of kind of sense of any sustainability, of being able to do things that are, Brighton and Hove City Council want to have a reputation for being slightly different, for being creative, and yet in this commissioning of two-year contracts, it's impossible to be creative. You just do the same old thing, because you can kind of prove it works, okay, but it isn't necessarily the best way to do things.
I think with commissioning, I think if they... The argument of going to the third sector is we're closer to...
Can I just say for listeners, when we refer to commissioning, we're actually saying buying services.
Buying services.
That's what
local
means.
Authorities or the NHS or central government.
Because local government has got a language all of its own, same as the NHS. But commissioning means buying services on a contract for a particular period.
Yeah. I forgot.
Sorry,
I just forgot what I was going to say now. I think they come to the third sector because we are closer to our communities, we're able to work better with risk, and we are innovative. And then what we find happens is that the commissioners over-prescribe what they want us to deliver. So they specify, we want you to deliver this service in this particular way. So any innovation, any feedback from our clients counts for nothing. So if commissioners said to us, we want you to deliver these outcomes, and then said, how you do it is entirely up to you, we could be far more effective than people who may never have actually delivered a service, who've worked in local authorities for most of their career, come to you and say, we know best, this is how you should do it.
We're going to take a break there, another musical break. Now, I don't know knowing Andy's choice, I don't know whether this is the time to have the dark, depressive music. Perhaps we'll do that, and maybe we'll end on Francis's choice for this section of the show. Tell us what you've chosen.
I wanted to cheer everyone up, so I brought some Leonard Cohen in. It's a year since Leonard Cohen died.
Right.
And one of his tracks that I particularly like is called Tower of Song. It's got some deep and meaningful lyrics. I don't understand them at all. They cannot explain them, but I think it's a great song.
Okay, let's listen to that, and then we'll come back and close this section before we bring in Daniel Yates, who's going to have the magic bullet for us all.
Well, my friends are gone, when I'll be back, they're moving us tomorrow to their town.
Welcome back. So before we got into some rather detailed discussion about how long contracts last and how this impacts on how you respond, but also you've added an extra layer of interest to this, is that the proposals seem to be confined to a very restrictive framework, which strangles innovation. Is that your experience, Francis? Because you've worked for a number of charities.
I think there are a couple of things. There's the short-term contracts, and then also I think the council are looking to work with bigger organisations who have the capacity to manage the monitoring and the financial monitoring. And I wonder if smaller organisations are being squeezed out by those decisions. So smaller charities who are even closer potentially to the coalface, to the community, are really excluded because they don't have the internal capacity. And we at Clock Tower Sanctuary, although we're a relatively medium-sized charity in Brighton and Hove, we at the moment aren't working on any council-commissioned work at all for that very reason, that the hoop jumping is just too difficult for us, and it takes us away from the frontline work that we're trying to do with young people who are homeless and who are in crisis. So we've taken that decision for the moment not to look to work with the council on any commissioned work.
I do know from my own experience with another hat that the actual responding to bids is a huge undertaking.
Yes.
And for smaller charities, that's quite an undertaking. But I see increasingly also, which seems to be another trend, and this may be very good, you two are both homeless charities, and the council seems to favour bids where there's some joint working with partner organisations. Does that throw up some particular cultural issues where there are two different organisations? Who leads? Are you duplicating? Does BHT partner with anyone?
We partner with a load of organisations, and we take to heart the concept of generous leadership. So taking on board Francis's point about larger organisations having more capacity, we will often write the bid on behalf of ourselves and partners. The most recent round of third sector commissioning required everyone to bid in partnership. Partnerships, I think, bring a great mix of expertise and cultures and can enrich a contract. But there should be a recognition that it is more time consuming to deliver, to prepare the bid and to deliver the contract in partnership. It can bring about some conflicts between the organisations. We lead a partnership of 60 organisations across the South East through the Fulfilling Lives initiative. And I remember chairing the very first meeting of that partnership, and it was quite a challenge.
But bringing it back to the point that we started at, Maria's point, if you're partnering with organisations who aren't signed up to the living wage and you as a lead organisation are signed up, does that in itself create some tensions because their finances will be completely skewed to living, you know, paying wages which are not living wage levels?
I think our primary partners are all living wage employers.
Okay. We're going to take a final musical break. So I come to you now, Francis, for some uplifting music. Tell us what it is, and we'll play out of this section before we bring in Councillor Daniel Leeds, who's going to solve all our problems.
Well, I'm a child of the 60s, and I've always loved Bob Dylan, and he's been part of my musical library for all of those years. So I'm going back to the early days, and appropriately I've chosen It's All Right, Ma, I'm Only Bleeding.
Darkness at the break of the moon.
OK, joining us now is Councillor Dan Yates. Dan, you are the chairman of the Health and Wellbeing Board on Brighton and Hove City Council. You're very welcome on board. With me is Maria Antonou, Francis
Duncan
and a small chap called Andy Winter. And we've been talking about pay rates in the third sector. And we seem to have focused on the strange practice of commissioners, particularly in the local authority and in the NHS, who seem to ask for bids both at the living wage rate and at a non-living wage rate. Do you think this is a good practice? Deathly silence.
It's very good practice in the city to be trying to get everybody paying the Brighton and Hove living wage.
Do you think there's a simple solution that if all councillors voted that the commissioners should be a favour in whatever way, maybe in the scoring system, only those third sector organisations who pay the living wage, we might get to a situation where charities and CICs, community interest companies, are forced or perhaps prompted to pay a better rate of pay for people working with them who deliver services to some of the city's most vulnerable people?
Well, certainly I'd agree that, you know, that a lot of this is down to how the procurement actually takes place. It's very difficult as an organisation for us to be able to mandate other organisations' pay scales and their pay rates. So part of it is about organisations that are bidding for work not getting drawn into a downward spiral of, you know, a battle to the bottom in pay rates and actually putting in appropriate level pay rates when they're bidding for work. Now I appreciate that doesn't sound like a very helpful scenario if there are other organisations that are trying to undercut them. But the crucial thing is that it's not just the financial benefits of a service that should be measured, and the cost of procurement shouldn't purely be measured in financial cost. It should be about that broader social value that's delivered out of paying somebody a decent wage so that we can help them to live, you know, sort of healthy and beneficial lives themselves, as well as the clients they're supporting.
I mean, earlier in the conversation, Andy Winter from BHT, Brighton Housing Trust, stated very categorically that his organisation had missed out on several contracts simply because they are a living wage employer and they costed the bundle of work using those rates. So it does look as if those third sector organisations trying to do right by their employees are losing out. Do you have a view on that?
Yeah, I mean, as I've just said, you know, what we don't want to do is to purely measure the value of a procurement or the value of a contract being awarded by the cost of it. You know, if we can actually make sure within our procurements that we've got measures that take a broader view and look at the social value that's being delivered, or actually put in requirements for, you know, pay levels and pay scales that we consider to be appropriate, then that's part of the process that we're trying to drive through the council. Remember, it's only, you know, 18 months ago that we signed up to Unison's Ethical Care Charter, so that within the home care market, we are making sure that we're paying our contractors and our staff in-house the Brighton Hove Living Wage.
But what about other third sector organisations? So an organisation like Clock Tower Sanctuary, where we've got the CEO sitting opposite me, and also Brighton Housing Trust. It's not been their experience so far that a realistically costed parcel of work wins the day. So where is the political will from all parties? Because although there's a minority Labour administration, you can't push this through without the support of other parties. Where is the political will to actually tell your commissioners that this is the formula you want to see applied?
Well, that's part of a package of work that's being picked up, you know, by the neighbourhoods inclusion communities and equalities.
Is that
committee
under Councillor Emma Daniel?
Yeah, and that's coming out of the work that was done by the Fairness Commission. Of course, one of the Fairness Commission findings was around the Brighton Hove Living Wage and the importance that it played in both the city's economy, but also in helping, you know, individual city residents and their families.
When can we expect that to arrive on Platform 9?
Oh, well, that unfortunately is the $1,000 question, isn't it, Geoffrey? You know, there's never a single end point for that, because there are procurements that are going on all the time, larger procurements, smaller procurements, you know, and pieces of work that are going on to develop those. And that's work that's undertaken through the council's procurement board, where they take a variety of different decisions based on a variety of different outcomes that they're looking for in order to inform the procurements that go on. But the city council is committed to the Brighton and Hove Living Wage.
And yet, Daniel, I seem to recall only a few months ago some work uncovered that the council was responsible for numerous zero-hours contracts, I thought certainly the Labour administration was again, certainly the Greens are. I can't speak for the Conservatives. They're probably, they can talk for themselves. But it seems to be lamentable that we are failing both in getting rid of zero-hours contracts and also not actually insisting upon living wage payers for our commissions.
The number of zero-hours contracts in the council as a whole is reducing. But it will almost.
But they're still there, aren't they? They're still there.
It will almost always be impossible to completely get rid of zero hours contracts, where some of the work is very, very much based on ad hoc shift work, you know, undertaken by people, some of whom wish to retain those sorts of contracts. But where we can, we're trying to reduce the number of zero hours contracts, because we don't agree that zero hours contracts should be a significant part of the city's economy.
Okay, I'm going to bring Francis into this. You've heard Dan and his take on things. What's your response to him?
Well, I think on the zero-hours contracts, it needs to be a very proactive move by the council and a political move to reduce those to as low as they can go. I think in terms of the commissioning, we absolutely have to reduce this unseen barrier between people who are paying the living wage and thus score not so well and those that are. And again, a political statement that proactively supports organisations paying the living wage would really go a long way to encouraging other people to sign up and to start paying the living wage.
I've got Maria Antonou, who's unfortunately at a disadvantage. She can't hear you. But during
that
our conversation...
That may be an advantage.
Say again? That may be,
that
an,
may
advantage.
Be an advantage.
You downplay your importance. But I just want her to comment, because we were talking about the impact on smaller charities and third sector organisations by the practice of commissioners to seemingly go for the lowest possible price, which puts some of the smaller charities delivering excellent services out of the running. Maria, what do you have to say about that? Is that something that you've seen as a consultant and someone working in frontline charities?
I think the disadvantages for charities are more than... Sorry. The disadvantages for charities are more than suggested there for smaller charities. It's the whole element of competition, I think, that the commissioning work... I've lost my thread now. Sorry,
that's
going to have to start
that's
back.
Okay. All right. Well, look, the notion was that smaller charities are being forced out of the marketplace because they simply can't compete with the bigger charities. I mean, is there, in your view, Dan, a move to place work only with the more substantial third sector organisations at the expense of the smaller organisations?
Absolutely not. If anything, I would argue that the council, you know, treats all charitable and voluntary sector organisations fairly and equitably. We provide a lot of resource through community works to make sure that they're supported to be able to deliver their strategic vision and their objectives. And, you know, and it's important for us not to confuse price and value. You know, that's the crucial thing that we have not to lose. You know, I talked about this race to the bottom. You know, what we don't want is a race to the bottom where we're just looking for the lowest possible price contractors.
Do you think that's what went wrong with the contract that which was commissioned, not by the council, but a consortium of NHS types for the co-performer contract, which went disastrously wrong? And it seemed to have been commissioned on the basis of the lowest possible price.
I think there were a variety of things that were done there that we need to learn from. You know, I think there were a catalogue of errors there, Geoffrey, and, you know, to simply blame the decision around who was successful in that procurement would be to understate the number of errors that were made throughout that entire process. You know, it's an excellent example of what can go wrong when money is too big a consideration in the delivery of service. Okay. What we want to do is we want to deliver high value services. You know, and we want to make sure that what we're not doing is driving, you know, smaller community and voluntary sector organisations out of business or out of the arena of being able to deliver the sorts of services that the council wants and they want to be, you know, delivering and providing on behalf of the city's residents.
Okay.
You know, we work with a lot of those organisations. We provide funding for those organisations. In some cases, we're also providing grant funding or core funding to those organisations to help sustain them. You know, we all have to work together. We know there's a limited amount of money available currently. You know, with Tory austerity, we're living in a very fragile society, but the best thing that we can all do is to work well together. And I agree, not pitting organisation against organisation.
Okay, on that positive note, I'm going to let you have your Desert Island disc moment. And to raise your spirits, perhaps you'd like to tell the listeners what you've chosen.
It's Who Wants to Live Forever by Queen.
Okay, I think that's going to be a particularly uplifting piece of music to end the programme. Thank you so much for joining us, and thank you for my guests in the studio.
Thank you.
There's no time for us.
The Politics Show on Radio Reverb 97.2 FM.
As we've heard, there are no easy answers to overcoming the challenges of low pay in the third sector. Increasingly, the City Council relies on those organisations to deliver vital services to Brighton and Hove's most vulnerable citizens. But to win the contracts to do that, it looks like overheads are being pared to the bone to meet the tight financial constraints being imposed by the Conservative government in Westminster. Too often, this places those third sector organisations in jeopardy. Getting more to sign up to paying the living wage will have an impact, and as we've heard, more are doing so. But as Andy Winter has said, the impetus could be accelerated greatly if Brighton and Hove City Council pledge only to commission services from living wage employers. But will they? We will have to wait and see. Thank you for listening. You can continue the conversation by visiting the programme's page on the Radio Reverb website, and that's where you can find details of Beth Munro's pleas for your votes. Goodbye.